Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up in the program, around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave Wyoming. We'll bring you the first in a series of conversations between young people exploring why.
There is so much that I need to experience so that way I can become this person for other people.
High-speed fiber optics is coming soon to the Wind River Reservation, but it hasn't been easy getting there.
Telephone companies typically do not know how to interact or interface with the tribal governments and thus decide to build around.
Two coal companies are joining forces to compete with natural gas and renewables. An expert explores what the collaboration means.
Going back 5-6 years, you can find analysts saying we need people to consolidate in the Powder River Basin.
Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Two of the largest coal producers are combining forces to better compete with natural gas and renewable energy. Peabody and Arch Coal are consolidating 7 of their mines, 5 in Wyoming and 2 in Colorado. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim talks to S&P Global Market Intelligence coal reporter Taylor Kirkendall. He explains what the collaboration means for the companies, the coal industry, and Wyoming going forward.
Peabody and Arch, two largest coal companies in the Powder River Basin. Peabody Energy, actually, the largest coal company in the U.S., are going to combine into a joint venture to operate their Powder River Basin and Colorado assets. That's a lot of several different mines, but most importantly, they're talking about the Black Thunder mine and the North Antelope mine. Those are the two largest mines in the region by far. It's almost up to a fifth almost of the coal that's produced in the U.S. is going to be run out of one mine. Now, those mines are already sharing, I believe, a 7-mile border. So the idea of being able to consolidate these two together and run them as one large unit is a big deal.
And it also, it combines 7 mines in total, right?
Correct. Mostly smaller mines.
Okay, and so the North Antelope Rochelle and the Black Thunder, that's the biggest thing, in your opinion, of the 7, that's the most important merger?
I think that's where we're naturally going to see a lot of these synergies they're talking about being unlocked. I believe they say something like, that the pre-tax synergies they're going to unlock are around $820 million. That's like something like $120 million a year that they're going to save by operating these two different complexes as one unit. I think a lot of that's going to be coming from combining Black Thunder and North Antelope, although, of course, sharing logistical systems and marketing systems with the rest of those mines are obviously going to be a big benefit as well.
So that's some of the background. Was this joint venture expected?
I think this kind of surprised everybody. Hadn't heard any rumors of this. A lot of times whenever there's a deal, you kind of hear whispers about it at conferences or something going on. I think that this was a surprise for most people. But this idea that Peabody and Arch are going to be putting these assets together into a joint venture out there, basically controlling, I don't want to say all, but pretty close to a large majority of the production out there is a really big deal. Shook up the energy industry.
So when do these changes actually start happening, or is there a possibility that it won't happen, that it won't get approved?
Yeah, that's actually a great point. And it's something I think that everybody's trying to watch closely right now. We don't really know exactly how long this process is going to take. Glenn Kellow, the president and CEO of Peabody Energy, did say on a call with the media last week that they are expecting it to be a several months long process. There is concerns that there might be some antitrust litigation coming out of this to the Federal Trade Commission. What we're trying to figure out is, will the FTC government body step in and decide that Arch and Peabody are creating something that's too large and is basically going to make a unfair competition for the other producers in the basin. But then also they can step back and take an even broader look. Coal prices are very low right now. A lot of coal companies are struggling to make a profit. Maybe that this kind of consolidation is exactly what would be needed to have a pricing structure in place that allows these companies to not only operate and mine coal, but also to sell at a profit. Again, not clear what's going to happen, but I think it's something that could definitely end up running into a regulatory hurdle as they try to complete this deal.
So to you, did it strike you as a desperation move to stay afloat and have a little more control, or was it a strengthening move? They were already both in better positions than most other coal companies, having shed their debt in the 2015-16 bankruptcies, and now they're saying, okay, let's just bolster our forces while we're in a safe position.
Yeah, I think I can see both positions coming out of this one, because there's a couple of different arguments we've heard in both, right? I've also even heard some people try to make the argument that maybe that they're setting this up so it's easier to spin out into its own venture and they can both focus on their metallurgical coal properties. Obviously nothing from the company on that, but that's something that, you know, could happen down the road. I do think that this, for the most part, is a move that's aimed to strengthen costs where it makes sense. We've heard analysts calling for this for years. I don't know how long exactly, but I know at least going back 5-6 years, you can find analysts saying we need people to consolidate in the Powder River Basin, or we need the broader coal sector to consolidate. Some people are still saying that about the metallurgical coal sector. Because the idea is, you know, your market's shrinking, you're overproducing. That overproduction is causing prices to be very low, which is, you know, great for utilities and customers that are able to buy that coal cheap, but really rough on these coal companies. But yeah, I think that this is both it's a strengthening move for the companies. I don't really see it as much of a desperation move. I don't think either one are really that desperate right now. Obviously, you look down the road, you can see some trouble ahead for the coal industry as that market share continues to shrink. But as of right now, they're both pretty healthy. They've been tossing money back to their shareholders. I really do think that this is just an opportunity for them to continue to move that coal. Because neither one of them, you know, could have gone out tomorrow and started out a new Powder River Basin coal mine of this size, because the demand's just not there. And so this kind of makes sense, I think, for both of them, especially, again, as we talk about Arch starting to kind of maybe focus some more on their eastern coal operations where they're, you know, selling metallurgical coal instead.
Okay, Taylor, thank you for talking.
Hey, thank you so much.
This week, President Trump signed another executive order that his administration says could help lower medical costs, but it's being met with skepticism by some, including one in the Wyoming congressional delegation. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the details from Washington.
On Monday, Trump signed an executive order giving his Health and Human Services Agency 60 days to flesh out the details of how to force hospitals to be upfront with patients about the costs of their procedures. It's intended to help average Americans shop around the marketplace for cheaper rates. And Wyoming's junior senator, John Barrasso, is fully on board.
I think people ought to know what it's going to cost before they actually undergo treatment. So I'm very happy that the president's done that. I've been working for years to try to make sure people knew what things cost and get the cost down. The competition will help in terms of forcing people to lower the cost.
Barrasso's a doctor by trade, and also now a member of the GOP leadership team in the Senate. He says transparency in medicine is essential.
Medical costs have been complicated, like airline costs. Very few people pay the exact same thing for tickets, but I think people ought to know what the cost is going to be specifically for them.
Barrasso's not alone. Even many Democrats want hospitals and doctors to be upfront with patients about costs. Here's Pennsylvania Democrat Brendan Boyle, who's supportive of the effort, even if he's got a big caveat.
In my view, anything we can do to bring more transparency to pricing and costs in healthcare is potentially a positive step. However, that alone is not going to come anywhere near solving the myriad problems we have when it comes to the cost of healthcare.
Boyle and other Democrats claim Trump and GOP leaders like Barrasso are merely nibbling around the edges. And he says it will come back to bite the Republican Party unless they sit down with Democrats and try to tackle the bigger issues that are causing medical prices to soar in Wyoming and elsewhere.
The reason why they lost in 2018, more than any other reason, was because of health care. And their drive to try to kick 29 million Americans off their health insurance and cancel Obamacare. The fact of the matter is the Republicans, if they want to preserve their Senate majority, and if they want to hold the White House in 2020, need to work with us to reduce health care costs in this country.
Even Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi isn't convinced that Trump's new purported effort at transparency will work.
Well, he signed an order to have his agencies work on it. We're a long way from being there.
Just this Wednesday, a bipartisan group of senators on the Senate's Health Committee passed a bill that has more teeth than Trump's executive order. And even if he's dubious about Trump's new order, Enzi is proud to be a part of this latest bipartisan effort.
I just left a health committee meeting where we passed out a bill that will make a difference.
The bill Enzi's committee sent before the full Senate would force hospitals and doctors to be upfront with their patients so they don't get smacked with surprise medical bills. It also seeks to lower the cost of drug prices. And Enzi says that legislation is better than any one-sided executive order, especially because it passed out of the committee with a bipartisan mix of 20 supporters and a mere 3 defectors.
Well, because it's had a lot of hearings and a lot of input from a lot of senators and is pretty bipartisan. And bipartisan can pass around here.
Still, the Trump administration and Senate Republican leaders are not clamoring to usher that bipartisan effort through this divided Congress. The administration is trying to force drug companies to list the costs of their drugs in ads that run on television, which is currently being challenged by 3 pharmaceutical companies. Barrasso likes that effort.
The drugs that are advertised on television seem to be the most expensive, and I think it's really important for people to know what those are going to cost before they go and ask their doctor about them. And that's what the administration's trying to do by making them post the cost of those drugs, the price, so that people that are watching the commercials will know what they're talking about.
Beside the new pharmaceutical price listing rules that could kick in this summer, Barrasso says Trump's newest executive order is all about the free market and competition, which he says will lower costs.
We shouldn't even have to be discussing this because people ought to know that already. You know, if you're going to buy a car, you're going to, you know, go out to dinner, go to the grocery store, you know what things cost. People ought to be able to know what things cost when they need health care.
Still, many experts say health care isn't like shopping for a car. It's more complex than that, which is why such a large bipartisan block of senators are trying to tackle the heart of America's soaring healthcare costs. They're just hoping 2020 presidential politics don't derail a broadly bipartisan effort before the train even starts rolling down the tracks. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, a political battle over managing Sheridan and the never-ending battle over beef labeling. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In 2015, Sheridan City Council decided to create a city administrator position to handle some of those day-to-day responsibilities of running the city. It was just the latest move in a long-standing debate in town. Sheridan City Council is considering now an ordinance to affirm the city administrator's duties. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explains.
Sheridan City Councilman Aaron Linden says the debate on city management isn't a new issue in town.
It's been a topic of conversation for a while.
And the conversation comes down to one question. Should a city administrator handle day-to-day operations so the mayor can focus on the bigger picture? About 4 years ago, Sheridan's then city council passed an ordinance that gave control of some daily responsibilities to a city administrator. But since that time, there has been some confusion over what the mayor is actually in charge of. On Monday, the city council will attempt to pass an ordinance specifically laying out the roles of the mayor and the administrator. Sheridan City Attorney Brendan Kearns says the mayor serves as the executive and the city administrator serves as an operator. Kearns says under the proposed ordinance, it's the city administrator, not the mayor, who has the power to give city employees direct orders.
That power flows through the city administrator under the charter ordinance. The mayor does not have the ability to order the city administrator or staff to go perform a specific function, with the exception of gathering information, providing that oversight, providing information for council.
Sheridan's mayor, Roger Miller, opposes the idea that the administrator should run the city.
It's one of those things that communities think is a great idea. You know, the city will run better. But what it does is it diminishes the roles and responsibilities, and in particularly what I've been saying all along is the authorities of the mayor to do what the mayor has by state law been assigned to do.
Miller says it makes the city government less accountable to the residents since the administrator is unelected and can make a lot of decisions. But the mayor is still the most powerful person on the city council. The mayor sets the agenda, has veto power, and provides oversight to the city's departments and the administrator. The side that wants the city administrator position believes that it helps to have a professional manager running the city. Administrators are usually trained for their work and they aren't elected officials, so they can stick around as mayors come and go, which can provide some institutional memory. Councilman Linden was on the committee that recently looked at if the administrator position is effective. He says he sees the value in the position.
My personal thought is it's been working great. The department heads are pleased. The staff is pleased. It seems to have alleviated some of the tension between knowing, you know, who is in charge or what real duties we're supposed to be carrying out based on whom.
The residents of Sheridan share the same disagreements over the position. Lots of people think the city has been running great since the administrator started and don't see a reason to change it. Sheridan resident Paul DeRossi said at a council meeting it leaves the mayor time to focus on policy and the overall direction of the city.
In my opinion, your role is not to directly manage the operational matters of the city of Sheridan.
But others would prefer the mayor run the city, and a big part of that has to do with the administrator's six-figure salary. Mayor Miller says he thinks a chief of staff would be a smarter solution and would be able to fill the gaps when it comes to daily operations. City Councilman Jacob Martin thinks an objective administrator is a better approach.
That's a stronger position than a chief of staff, and it also adds continuity, and he's able to teach our department heads a lot.
The council will hold its last vote on the clarification ordinance on Monday. So far, a majority of the council has voted in its favor and supports continuing with an administrator. Mayor Miller stresses that if the ordinance passes and residents object, 10% of qualified voters have 60 days to sign a petition to bring the ordinance to a public vote. Miller says in his mind, the issue is a long way from being settled. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
When it comes to beef, made in America doesn't necessarily mean it was made here. That's because if the cow was raised in another country, it can be labeled with a USDA sticker as long as it was processed here. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, that has ranchers in a beef with each other over what to do about it.
Mark Isley is owner and operator at King Ranch, just a few miles outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Out here, he says, his life is built around the wind.
Trees all lean to the east, our telephone poles lean to the east, the barn doors are on the east side. Yeah, it's a constant way of life.
The other thing that rules his world, beef. More specifically, the price of beef. That number has been all over the place in the last few years, and cattle ranchers are divided about how their cows can command higher prices.
It's a very emotional issue, and maybe just a general misunderstanding of the market.
Isley says ranchers get emotional because it's their livelihood. The rising and falling of beef prices has been hard on them. For him, the solution is looking for opportunity outside of the U.S.
We are in an export market. We need to sell our beef overseas.
He's talking about Asia, increasing urbanization and a growing middle class in countries like China and Japan have fueled a demand for beef. Right now, Australia and Brazil are dominating those markets, but Isley says American cattlemen have a chance to take over.
Those guys want quality. They want a great tasting product. They're willing to pay a little more for it, especially as they emerge and they become more economically viable.
But growing that overseas market isn't enough, according to Bill Bullard. He heads up the Ranchers and Cattlemen Action Legal Fund.
If we could distinguish our product, we could promote and advertise our product as being produced under the highest health and safety standards in the world.
And he says the way to do that is to have mandatory country of origin labeling on all beef.
Otherwise, it's set side by side with imported meat that may not be as tasty. And if consumers have a bad experience eating the beef, and they would presume that it must be domestic product because it bears a USDA inspection sticker on it, then that lessens demand for beef totally.
Country of origin labeling isn't a new idea in the meat industry. The government required it for beef from 2009 to 2015, but Congress outlawed it to comply with global trade rules. Bullard says then President Trump was elected.
Well, we were actually elated when he came out with his executive order urging the Buy American, Hire American program.
Bullard says he thought that meant the Trump administration would reverse the decision, but that's not happened. That might be because of the way consumers behave. Take the butcher block in Laramie, Wyoming. It's owned and operated by Alan Johnson. What's your sort of impression when people see a label that says made in the U.S., what they make of that?
I actually haven't had anyone ask that specifically or look for that specifically.
Instead, Johnson says he mostly gets questions about hormones or steroids. That tracks with what Chris Bastian has concluded.
As long as consumers feel their product is safe, they don't care where they get it from.
Bastian's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wyoming. He's talking about a USDA study back in 2015 on the effectiveness of country of origin labeling.
When the label just says certified U.S. product, what does it really convey to the consumer?
For instance, do they attach a sense of pride when buying U.S. products or view it as being safer or of higher quality?
And then they have to act on that.
But Bastian says the U.S. Department of Agriculture study found that the labeling didn't change consumer behavior. In fact, it concluded labeling did more harm than good. Overall, the extra red tape and record keeping was estimated to cost ranchers, producers, retailers, and consumers over $8 billion over 10 years. Still, supporters like Bill Bullard aren't giving up.
Country of origin labeling is the essential element to allow our U.S. farmers and ranchers to compete against the growing volume of imported products that the meat packers are bringing into this country.
And he has at least one political leader in his camp. Montana Senator John Tester plans to reintroduce the idea in a Senate resolution this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we begin a series on why young people leave the state. And high-speed internet comes to the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave Wyoming every year. So over the next several months, Wyoming Public Radio News brings you the Belonging Series, conversations with young people exploring their place in Wyoming and the world. Because June is Pride Month, the first conversation we'll share is between Connor Sears and Jesse Archambault. The two graduated from Cheyenne East High School in 2018 and left for college in Peoria, Illinois, where they found a prominent LGBTQ community. But they struggle with how their absences perpetrate a trend that leaves Wyoming's queer youth without the mentorship they themselves yearn for.
Tell me about a time where you felt like you did have a sense of belonging in Wyoming.
That's the tricky part. There were moments where I did feel defended. I felt like people stuck up for me. One specific memory I can recall is sitting in my sophomore year Spanish class. I had Miss Karen Pope, may she rest in peace. I had been sat next to a kid who was very comfortably homophobic, very unapologetically homophobic, you know? Yeah. And I, you know, I remember it was like the little instances that made it the worst. If I touched a pencil, he would throw it away. You know, it was like the little things. It wasn't him ever like writing the F word all over my assignments and whatnot. It was the little things, but nevertheless, there was one day where she kept me back and she said, "Hey, what's up? What's going on? Because I notice you feel uncomfortable and I just want to know, you know, like, how can I help you? What's up?" And I remember telling her everything, spilled it all out there. And the first thing she said was, "In this room, that will never happen again." And it was that moment that I felt like there was someone who was ready to go to bat for me. It's those little moments that are what matter. Did you ever have a moment?
I remember when I came out to my mom for the first time. She was really accepting of it, but we got into this fight about whether or not I should be out, essentially. And I wanted to tell people, I wanted to tell my friends, I wanted to tell my teachers and be out and proud, wear my gay stuff everywhere. And my mom was against that. She didn't want that to happen. And I wasn't really understanding why. And that was the first time I ever heard of Matthew Shepard. And she told me basically like there was this awful hate crime that happened very close to here. And I don't want that to happen to you. And that was kind of when I realized like, I have a lot that I need to do, and I don't really know if Wyoming is the best place for that to flourish.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad you bring that up, because my mom is very, very much the same way. You know, and I think I wondered for a really long time if it was, are you ashamed of it, or are you worried for me? And now I've come to the conclusion that they were just worried, especially because of Matthew Shepard.
Have you ever second-guessed your choice to leave Wyoming, and what stopped you from coming back?
Yes. I actually think about it a lot. And I think I've thought about it a lot more recently than I did initially. I was at the beginning of the year after leaving Wyoming at the beginning of, you know, like last fall, I think I was swept up in the change that I didn't really notice it. But hearing about the incident at McCormick Junior High School, it kind of made me sit back and think, Wyoming is dying for activists right now, and I'm not there. And I think I felt guilty going to a state that is fairly progressive and does have a lot of policies that celebrate queer identities and protect queer identities. Yeah, I do reflect on that a little bit. And even to this day, sometimes I think that while I am happy with my choice, I could be doing a lot of awesome activist things here.
A lot of my friends are still in Wyoming, and in Peoria, I remember there was a moment where I just felt really alone. I was still growing into my spot in college and finding new people to be around, and I was completely separated from everybody that I used to know. And I thought I should go back. And I think what kept me in Peoria was, ever since probably about middle school, I've been exploring gender identity. That was always a kind of journey that I went on by myself that I never really got to ask someone about. I remember being in elementary school and like Googling, "Am I gay?" on Google, and it would have been very nice to have a person tell me, if you're Googling if you're gay on Google, you're probably gay. So being in Peoria, I was with a lot of friends and they were talking about someone, and I remember them using they-them pronouns just flawlessly. They were respecting that person's gender identity, and that was something that was just very eye-opening for me, in the fact of there is so much that I need to see. There is so much that I need to experience so that way I can become this person for other people. I can become the girl who takes a freshman by the shoulder and says, "You don't need to apologize for existing."
Yeah, similarly, I would say that the way I've started to view it, or tried to view it, is that leaving Wyoming, I was a little baby activist. And then right now, I'm at a point in my life where I am trying to become as unapologetic, as powerful, as intelligent, as well-versed, as well-read as I possibly can, so that, you know, after my 4 years or after my 5 or 8 or however many years, I can come back and I can say confidently, we need social change.
It's very nice to see narratives of survival within the queer community.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice to see people who have made it to 21, people who have made it to 50, people, and just having a place where you can share this sense of survival and resistance and community that mm-hmm. just people are together existing and being okay with it. And you can be okay with however you are as well.
That's Jesse Archambault speaking with Connor Sears for our series Belonging, where we ask young people to reflect on their place in Wyoming. Charles Fortier produced this piece. For the last few years, both the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes have been working to bring fiber optics to the Wind River Reservation. A lack of broadband connectivity is a problem across rural America, and it can even be harder in Indian country. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards explains.
It's dumping rain the day Patrick Lawson gives me a tour around Wind River Internet's warehouse. He points out a pile of yellow plastic signs.
These are the markers that you'll see around the reservation and in Riverton. But you'll see the little tribal logo on there, and it says warning fiber optic cable. And that means if you see that, you can probably get internet from us.
Lawson is the head IT guy for the entire Northern Arapaho tribe. And that's saying something because the tribe is one of only 14 in the country that is their own telecommunications carrier. About a decade ago, they started this business to offer its members wireless internet because none of the other big telecommunications carriers would.
It's not appealing to other providers to come in and go to individual residence homes. Usually what they do is they come in and they go to just like the schools or clinics or you know, the places with the bigger pockets. And they kind of leave the others behind.
The tribe is over 10,000 strong, spread across 1.8 million acres. So getting internet to each and every home is daunting. But that's exactly what the Northern Arapaho plan to do in the next 10 years. Lawson shows me a map of the reservation.
All those little purple dots or houses are homes passed, so we're running a dedicated fiber optic cable past every single one of those homes.
Lawson says this could help the tribe in so many ways. Help entrepreneurs sell their wares on a global market, or put a doctor right in someone's home. That could help reduce health disparities on Wind River, where the life expectancy is only 54 years old.
We could have a Denver person operating on somebody in Riverton. Instead of transporting the patient to Denver, they could do it remotely, which I think would be amazing.
High-speed internet could also put teachers in people's homes. And distance learning is something Central Wyoming College in Riverton is chomping at the bit to offer. Vice President of Student Affairs Coralina Daly says tribal students often struggle to make it to class.
You know, sometimes it can be 15 people that are relying on the same vehicle, and if somebody has to go to a medical appointment in Billings, you're not coming to class that day. And so it's really a heartbreak when that's what gets in the way.
Daly says if those students could access class from a computer screen, more students would succeed. But there are some hurdles to bringing fiber optics to the reservation.
Telephone companies typically do not know how to interact or interface with the tribal governments and thus decide to build around.
That's Talawa tribal member Forrest James. He's CEO of InterTribe, an organization that mediates with tribal governments on economic development projects like these. He says he's seen that fiber optics is a lifeline for Native communities.
Now they have tribal members moving back to the reservation because they can actually continue their education right there at home. I think one of the biggest challenges that we have in Indian country is getting our membership, getting our citizens to come back home, to be able to offer them jobs if they do, and to be able to keep them.
James is working with the tribes and Union Wireless, a family-owned carrier serving Wyoming and parts of the Mountain West. He says he's gotten a lot of fiber optics projects off the ground, but this has been truly unique.
The idea of a public-private partnership between two tribal governments and a local telephone company, of which the local telephone company is paying for the infrastructure, it is almost unheard of and such a wonderful example that I want to duplicate it.
Forrest says an alignment of stars made it happen. In the last few years, the two Wind River tribes have become more motivated to collaborate with each other. And Union Wireless has an unusual mindset.
So they operate in a very principally driven manner, which is needed in Indian country. Working with tribes, you essentially have to contribute to the community.
You know, when we went into this, I believe I told both business councils that, you know, Union was not being altruistic in its intentions here. We expect to get something out of it.
That's Brian Woody with Union Wireless. That something they want is 25 years of access to the fiber optics infrastructure they plan to give each tribe. That would expand their network to give them access to more customers on the reservation and beyond.
For us, every customer matters, so we really work hard and strive hard to earn our customers' business. You know, even if it's over a mountain range, they're still kind of our neighbors, and we still need to try to take care of them as best as we can.
That's a challenge region-wide. 39% of rural America lacks access to high-speed internet. In urban America, it's only 4%. The project on Wind River could be a good template for connecting homes across the West. For Wind River Internet's Patrick Lawson, his goal isn't just to be on par with the reservation's neighboring communities.
That's not good enough. If it's only just a little bit more to increase things from, you know, 10 times better to being 100 times better, let's aim for that 100 times better and ask, why not aren't we doing something that's 1,000 times better?
Construction on the two projects is expected to start next spring. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
We should note that Union Wireless is an underwriter for Wyoming Public Radio. In 2016, author and journalist Heather Hansman set out to paddle the Green River from its start in the Wind River Mountains, 700 miles to its confluence with the Colorado River in Utah. Her goal was to understand this tributary, who got to use its water, and why. Now she is out with a new book called Downriver. She told Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard why she chose the Green River.
My background is that I had been a river guide for a long time before I was a journalist. And the Green was kind of the first big Western river I'd ever paddled. I'm from the East Coast originally. And when I was in college, I came out and I ran Desolation Canyon, which is in northern Utah on the Green. And it was just this like beautiful, perfect sort of like dream of a river trip. And so I kind of had this idea in my head that that was the river. And then when I started thinking about kind of this problem of water use and water rights, and, you know, given climate change, how there wasn't potentially going to be enough water to go around, I started thinking about all the different groups of people who use water, from ranchers to cities to, you know, ecosystems and habitats. And the Green kind of had all the pieces that I was looking at in the pie. So there's kind of all these different threads that pulled me to the Green. And it's the biggest tributary of the Colorado. And the Colorado felt like this sort of big, massive, almost intangible thing to talk about. And the Green felt like a little bit more of a manageable chunk. And I was pretty sure that I could paddle the whole thing when I was thinking about it. So it kind of had all the pieces.
One of the threads that kind of runs through the book is that idea of ownership of water. How did you go into this experience thinking about that?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. When I was in, right before I started, I was up in Pinedale, Wyoming in the Wind River Range talking to this woman, Linda Baker, who's a kind of a environmental advocate there. She was like, water is such a tricky thing because it's everybody's and it's nobody's. And you have this idea that kind of water is for everybody, but then we also have it broken up kind of by, you know, you can own a water right and you can kind of have, it becomes almost a property thing. And I think for me, that was sort of a framework for, especially right off the bat going into it, this idea that like water was for everybody, but not everybody got the same amount of access to it.
You frame the book through stakeholders and you make a point to search out and hear from each of them. We hear from agriculture, cities, conservationists, recreationists. Did you come to any sort of conclusion about how all of those interests and stakeholders can be balanced?
You nailed it pretty much. I think balance is sort of the goal. And I think that's a really tricky thing to try and achieve, especially when water, you know, water scarcity feels really scary because it is life and livelihood for most people. But I think the places where I saw kind of the most progress and the most kind of change that looked helpful or hopeful rather were places where there were sort of minor changes coming from many different stakeholders. It was places where people were trying to figure out water markets or ways to, you know, build fish habitats into agriculture land or find ways to use urban water more efficiently.
With so many stakeholders and fights over water being so political and so huge, did being physically on the river change how you saw any of those fights and squabbles?
That, for me personally, this was kind of the biggest wake-up call and all that. Like, there's not necessarily any right way or kind of any good guy or bad guy or sort of best way to look at who owns the water. And I think more and more as there's going to be, you know, more people moving west and less water, this idea of kind of having to put it to multiple use and having to use the water as efficiently as possible became more and more clear. Going in, you know, I had come from a recreation side and a paddling side, and you kind of look at the math of water rights and who gets the most water. And in Wyoming, you know, agriculture gets almost 90%. And it's kind of easy from a pullback perspective to be like, oh, that's not fair. Why do they get that much? And then you go, you know, right off the bat, I met some of these ranchers kind of outside of Pinedale. And these folks, their families have been doing it for 150 years. And they have very clear reasons for why they use water the way they do and how their flood irrigating trickles down into the aquifer and provides habitat. And it just, you know, seeing what actually happened on the ground gave me it made the story much more complicated, but it gave me a much more sort of subtle understanding of why people do things the way that they do and why everyone, for the most part, everyone I met was trying to do the best good that they could kind of within the framework of what they were working with.
Heather Hansman is an author. Her book, Down River, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Cody Firearms Museum has a new look, and a Sheridan artist has received a national honor. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. On Saturday, July 6th, the newly renovated Cody Firearms Museum at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West will reopen its doors to the public. It's long been home to one of the largest firearm collections in the world. As Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports, the museum is trying to move away from just a display of guns to telling a story of the role of firearms in American culture.
The curator of the Cody Firearms Museum leads me through the recently remodeled galleries. It doesn't look like a typical gun museum. Brightly colored cases are filled with firearms, antique ones from the Wild West period, but also modern automatic rifles and handguns. And in the middle of the first room, you can learn how to handle a gun safely. Visitors can even practice a bolt action. Ashley Lubinsky beckons me into the next gallery.
So we're walking into the Military History Gallery, and one of the first things you see is this really large wall that has the words Cost of War on it, and the subtitle, Few Human Endeavors Are as Costly as Armed Conflict.
Lubinsky tells me the military history section of the newly remodeled Cody Firearms Museum is the gallery she is proudest of. As she says, it addresses one of the main objectives of the renovated museum.
Culture has changed over the past 20 to 30 years, and one thing we really wanted to do in the new museum was recognize that we have a very diverse audience base.
A diverse audience that may have different reactions and opinions on guns. This museum has been around for a long time, but mostly it was just gun collectors and gun enthusiasts that wandered in. The remodel wants to make sure that it's not a bunch of guns without much context. In order to do that, Lubinsky recruited not only firearm historians, but also academic historians not focused on guns.
Visitors will have a relationship to firearms that is associated with the harsh realities of gun violence, of frontier violence, of suicide, of mass shootings, of domestic violence and injuries.
Jennifer Tucker is one of those academic historians. She helped the museum look at guns through the lens of technology and visual culture.
One could look at the relationship to the history of labor, to the history of policing, also perhaps looking at legal history. Contrary to its name, the Wild West was the setting for the passage of some of the nation's first gun control laws.
The museum also recruited a professional museum designer to ensure it was interactive. Patrick Gallagher is the owner of that design firm. He says the museum can't ignore that daily news is bringing negative connotations about guns.
They're part of the historical language of this country. And because obviously we're in a very polarized political climate right now, they can be a flashpoint. Well, they can also be a teaching moment.
He says he hopes people who may not be the biggest fan of guns can leave the museum feeling like they learned something.
You may not walk out and say, I now fully respect gun owners, but you'll have a different perspective. We're not there to necessarily win people over. We're just there to be able to help them open their eyes.
The newly remodeled gun museum will reopen next week. Gallagher hopes the new permanent museum will facilitate a healthier dialogue around guns. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Godalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
A Wyoming artist, James Jackson, has received a National Heritage Fellowship. It's the nation's highest honor that celebrates traditional and folk art. Jackson is most well known for his intricate leather carving and spent most of his career at King's Saddlery in Sheridan. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler sat down with Jackson in his leather shop in the Brinton Museum to talk about how his career has been infused with Wyoming's culture.
Tell me a little bit how you got started in the saddle working and leather work in particular. What about it interested you and made you want to pursue it for a career?
Well, when I started doing leather work, it was in my father's shop. And this went on all the way through high school. When I was a sophomore in high school, I started working at the old Ernst Saddlery. And that's where my father was the head saddle maker. Now, at that point in time, I was just getting out of high school. I was doing a lot of drawing and painting, and I wanted to pursue a career in the arts, because working at a leather shop was just too much work. But as time went on, I really developed a love for working with leather, with the material. And I started building my own tools and doing various kinds of things like that. And after I graduated from the university, I went down to Denver for a few years and made a living as a painter. But I still maintained a leather shop as well. I always loved Sheridan, this area, and so I came back here. And when I came back, Don King wanted me to work for him, and I worked for King's Saddlery for close to 30 years.
How do you feel about like the National Endowment for the Arts recognizing the value in not only your personal work, but the entire trade you're a part of?
I think maybe the reason that they found my work interesting, at least I hope so, is the fact that my work, I try to draw it directly from my experience in this particular culture in Wyoming. It's a slow process, but as you work and over the years, you tie more and more of your culture into the type of work that you do. It's hard to explain how a tooling of flour and leather talks about your culture, but it does. The things I've built over the years, there's a lot of long hours, a lot of hard work, and I tried to absorb as much of the culture as I possibly could. The arts have a way of telling us who we are. So for me, being recognized on the national level like that is wonderful.
Like you said, you're retired from King's. What are you doing now, and how do you see your art progressing in the future? What are your plans?
You know, I can't retire. It's not the way I am. I've always had a need to produce work, and there's this creative need inside of me somewhere to want to create and build things and work. It's a stimulation for my mind and for my soul. I was very fortunate because the Brenton, when I left King's, they said, well, come out here a few days a week and do have your little shop and do kind of an educational kind of thing. I've been doing some other things as well as doing the leatherwork. So I'm helping to curate some shows because I worked as a curator at the university, and the director here, Ken Schuster, knows that. So he taps into my curatorial experience as well. So those things continue on, even though I'm getting to be an older guy. I still want to do these creative kinds of things and continue on in that direction.
Thank you, James, for sitting down with me. And again, congratulations on the fellowship.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I appreciate your interest in my work, and it's been lovely talking with you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show, want to hear an individual segment, you can find everything via our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. Also, never miss an episode by signing up for our podcast on that website or wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to rate it. And a rater is our web editor. Next week is an encore airing of our national award-winning Open Spaces featuring the topic of a Gillette mosque. Don't miss it. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.